The first slide, please, could we have that? What we're going to do this morning is to talk about the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet. It's kind of special, the 10th commandment, because it has to do with what happens in your mind rather than what you do. You remember the words from the book of Exodus, chapter 20, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his manservant, or his maidservant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Now, very few of us have an ox or a donkey today, and even fewer of us have a manservant or a maidservant. So I think in the next slide we might update that to contemporary conditions. That's right. So here's a modernized version of the same thing, you might say. Do not covet anything you have no right to possess. This is not a complete list, but here are some examples. Someone's house, or job, or car, or family, or spouse, or personality, or health. Indeed, you are not to covet anything that belongs to another. Now, there's a kind of worrying aspect to all this, at least it worries me when I read these words. When do you stop healthy admiring and when do you start coveting? For example, I might covet the band's musical abilities. I might admire them. Or Frank's head of hair. Or Steve Moss's ability at fishing. And I might say, I wish I could do that, or I wish I had that. But when does that spill over into coveting? Well, I think you say, well, that's easy. Covet's a bad word that means something unpleasant. But that's not really true either. In the Old Testament, the word that's translated as covet just means to desire. And it can be either the bad sense or the good sense. It's related to the words for beauty or beloved or pleasant or precious or goodly or delightful. But of course, it can also mean the bad sense, to covet something or to lust after something. What a contrast. So the question I'm asking myself this morning is, what is the boundary between praiseworthy ambition and the sin of covetousness? How do I tell what's a healthy desire and what's an unhealthy one? Now we're going to start off with a quiz, and this is to test how well you've been paying attention to what's going on in the world. I'm going to show you three pictures of people, and if you shout out, if you recognise them, and you get points, and points mean prizes. So anybody, it's not terribly good, but anybody recognise this chap in the news a month or two ago? I'll give you a clue. He came from the north of England. Not the policeman, I mean, he's easy, isn't he? Sorry? He's a man who disappeared a while ago and then came back. So that's Mr. Darwin. He's the chap that disappeared a few years ago or some years ago, and his wife claimed his life insurance and all that stuff, and he was thought to be drowned at sea. And of course, he turned up in South America, although he was kind of unwise to hang about the north of England as well at times. And how about the next chap? We recognise him. The background might give a clue. He's standing in front of the House of Commons. Conway. It's Mr. Conway, the MP, who got into trouble for fiddling his expenses. Now, here's one that's a bit older. Who's this chap? That's the easy one. That's Robert Maxwell. So these were all people who got themselves into a fix because of their the sin of covetousness, you might say. So I was watching a program the other evening about Robert Maxwell, a remarkable man, really. In the next slide, son. So he was born, he was called Jan Ludwig Hoch, he was his name, and he was born to a poor Jewish family in Czechoslovakia in 1923. And of course, in his early youth, he lost both his mother and his father, and eight brothers and sisters during the Nazi occupation of Czechoslovakia. He escaped. He was the only one who escaped. And he arrived in the United Kingdom at the age of 17. and he joined the army. Now, he joined the least prestigious bit of the army. He joined the Pioneer Corps. And those of you who are a bit older will, and did national service will remember that these are the chaps who lay the roads and dig the holes in the army. Not exactly the Brigade of Guards, the least prestigious bit of the forces. But then in 1943, he transferred to the North Staffordshire Regiment, and he was among the British forces that landed in Normandy in 1945. And by the end of the war, he was a captain in the Royal Army, and he collected a military cross along the way. And you don't generally get a military cross for nothing. It's a fairly prestigious award. And then after the war, he set up a publishing empire. Pergamon Press developed into, and he owned the Mirror Group of newspapers, and a host of other companies involving television and recording and so on, and also in football. Oxford United and Derby County Football Club, he had an interest, if not ownership, of these, and even attempted at one point to buy Manchester United. And in addition to that, he was a Labour MP, so this was a man who was a social and business success, you might say. He was known generally as Captain Bob. But then, of course, his dishonest business practices caught up with him, and it all ended in disaster. And he then became known as the Bouncing Cheque. And then in 1991, you'll recall perhaps some of you, that he disappeared. He was out in his yacht in the Atlantic, and he just disappeared. And he was found drowned, I think, on the coast of Portugal or someplace, and it was thought that perhaps he'd committed suicide. And then it was only at that point that it became apparent just how bad things were, that he plundered the employees' pension funds of £350 million and he left a lot of people without a pension. So here was a driven man who achieved a lot, who did many laudable and good things. He had ambition and energy, and these are often good traits, and nothing can be achieved without them. But in the end, it ended in disgrace and disaster for himself and for his wife and his family. And of course, it ended up in a lonely death in the middle of the Atlantic. So the question I'm asking myself today is, what is the boundary between praiseworthy ambition and the sin of covetousness? How do I tell what is a healthy desire and what is an unhealthy one? And the next slide gives us the characteristics of covetousness, which I think the Bible says are unhealthy, which tell us the difference between these two things. Covetousness is unwholesome. Covetousness is inappropriate. Covetousness is inordinate. Covetousness is ungodly. Covetousness is motivating. So at the first and most basic human level, covetousness is unwholesome. It's got a nasty quality about it. At the basic human level, it involves envy. Not only do I note and admire what another person has, his car, his house, his job, his personality, his wife, or reputation, and so on. I'm envious of it. I resent it. I'm eaten up with anguish because of it. I want to take it away from him, if possible, for myself. Covetousness is unwholesome. And then covetousness is inappropriate. At its simplest level, it's the wish to possess something which belongs to another. Somebody has said, it's not wanting more that is condemned, but wanting it at the expense of others. It's inappropriate desire, because it's desiring something which belongs to someone else. And then it's inappropriate because it's illegitimate. It's wanting something which is not legitimate for me to have. And somebody else has said, it's illegitimate desire for something that belongs to someone else. I'm desiring something which is out with the sphere of what is permissible, something which I might not rightly desire. And then not only is it unwholesome and inappropriate, but it's inordinate desire. Matthew Henry in his commentary says this: "This commandment forbids all inordinate desire." It's desire which is exaggerated to such a degree that it's passionate, it's forceful, it's difficult to resist, it's uncontrollable. It's wishing something in that uncontrollable and inordinate way. But the basic problem is none of these things. The basic problem is that it is ungodly. It's driven by the self, ignoring the welfare of others. The real problem is that it's unguided by God. Remember the words of James in his letter: "What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You want something but don't get it. You kill and covet, but you cannot have what you want. You quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask God." God is not the guiding principle. God is not even in the equation. Covetousness is ungodly desire. And then fifthly, covetousness is motivating. It may lead to action. Somebody has written the 10th commandment is where the Decalogue ends, but it is in fact the point where every breach of the law begins. Covetousness. Desire is engendered. It's directed at the illegitimate. It's powerful. It's driving. It's inordinate. It's guided by self-interest alone without reference to the Creator. And there's the ever-present possibility that it will lead to action in the right circumstances. If the opportunity comes along, will I act upon these motives which are within? Again, Matthew Henry says, "Thou shalt not covet," forbids all those irregular appetites and desires which are the beginning of all the sin which is committed by us. There's the possibility of me acting. And again, to quote someone else, he quotes a writer from the last century, "Improper desire is the root of all evil. It can seldom be reached by human legislation, but it is open to the searcher of hearts. You shall not covet." Now, you might say, I don't see the point in this 10th commandment. What goes on in my mind is my own business. What harm can it be doing anybody else what I think? Well, this commandment is important for the following reasons in the next slide. First of all, it tells me something important about the heart of men and women. And then it tells me something important about the heart of God. It takes me to the core of the human personality, and it takes me to the heart of God. So first of all, it tells me something important about the heart of men and women in the next slide. You see, the commandments begin and end with the thoughts. The first commandment, no other gods, no idols. The last commandment, no coveting. They begin and they end with the thoughts. John Calvin's remarks, God's objective is not only to condemn ungodly action. The ungodly action would come in the middle with the deeds, wouldn't it? God's objective is not to only to condemn ungodly action, but to restrain ungodly desires. He says, inward purity of the heart is everywhere required. And again he says, he not only imposes obedience on our feet and our hands, but also upon our hearts. God is interested in my thoughts. He's interested in what I am. He's interested in my motives. He's interested in the source of what I do. Now, the reason for that is that what I do might damage other people, but what I am and what I think damages me. Again, quote says this, the last commandment is the most searching. It forbids desire. It has been said that the sting is in the tail. There is nothing more harassing than a desire for what we cannot have. It is one of the great blights on human happiness. And of course, Jesus' emphasis was the same, wasn't it? You remember his words, "For from within, out of men's hearts come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly." This commandment is important because it takes me to the core of the human personality. And then, in the next slide, this commandment is important because it tells me something about God, about the nature of God, because God is uncovetous. Covetousness is the opposite to God's nature. God's nature is giving, gracious, generous. We see that in the way he chose his Old Testament people. Abraham, when he was yet an idolater in Ur of the Chaldees, and he blessed him and said he would make him great. In you will all the families of the earth be blessed. And the people Israel he chose, not because of their number, of their strength, of their holiness, but because they had nothing, because they were less than all the nations, and he called them. God is uncovetous. His nature is to give. He's characterized by causeless grace. And then when you look at the law in the Old Testament, how the law is designed to benefit the powerless. There's provision for the poor. The corners of the fields are left unreaped so that they might reap them. There's liberty for the slave in the year of Jubilee every 50th year. There's protection for the widow, relief for the captive.